The discussion this morning, the first discussion, will be on world perspectives. 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, to a certain extent, we would have been discussing the theoretical nature of the collapse of capitalism. Today, every day, every time you open the newspaper on a day-to-day basis, the reality of the crisis that is facing capitalism stares you in the face. On Wednesday, for example, the World Bank declared that 33 countries in the world were facing upheaval because of riots over food. 800 million people on a world scale, according to the United Nations, go to bed hungry every day. On Thursday, it was announced that certain people in the world are actually making a profit out of the crisis that we are going through. US recession, the article was called, it's a hedge fund heaven. And they mention a guy called John Paulson, whose pay packet in 2007 reached $3.7 billion. How did he get that money? By betting on the way the stock market would move, either up or down. So for these hedge fund managers, if the stock market goes up, they win. If the stock market goes down and there's an economic crisis, they also win. But the great thing is that what I loved about this quote, it says the magazine that gave this information said, this may well prove to be the greatest display of individual wealth creation. The bourgeois believes that this is a way to actually create wealth, not producing commodities, but by betting on the stock market. And then on Friday, the chief economist of the Bank of England came forward and said, we're in a difficult situation. We don't know whether the rate should go up or down because we're on a knife edge between rising inflation and a deepening credit crunch. So we even see that the strategists of the system itself, of capitalism in Britain and on a world scale, are undecided as to which way forward for themselves in order to save their own system. We have no doubts about the ideas that we should be fighting for in order to transform this system of capitalism into a socialist society. And that's the reason we are here this weekend, to discuss those ideas, to go away refreshed, to continue the battle in the coming year. So without further ado, I'll ask Alan. Alan's going to speak for about an hour, more or less. I'll be quite strict on the time he's got, and we'll have plenty of time for discussion. Thank you, comrades.
Well, comrades, I have today an impossible task. As Darrell said in his opening remarks, the situation that now faces us is not an abstract question. In the past, we had very good discussions on world perspectives. The perspectives were correct. But if we're to be truthful, they had a somewhat abstract character. That was of necessity, because in order to become more concrete, the actual events must unfold and furnish the necessary information. I think as a result of that, perhaps some comrades, older comrades over a period, were a little bit sceptical, perhaps, on occasion. I don't think at this moment in time there's a single comrade, a single intelligent person in the world, that looks at what is happening in the world, that can have any doubt whatsoever about the correctness of the perspectives of this organization, of this tendency, of this international, for decades. We start with the economy, and I will not spend much time on the economy. I don't, first of all, because I don't consider it's necessary. Any theoretical discussion ultimately is settled by facts, by events. And any discussions that might have taken place in this tendency in the past has been settled by events, is being settled by events, as far as the world economy is concerned. But from our point of view, we are not, with respect to our comrades who are professional economists or interested in political economy, we are not economists. We are revolutionary Marxists, we are activists in the workers' movement struggling to change the world. And therefore, from our point of view, if the discussion in economics only has value, only has interest, insofar as it casts light upon the class struggle. And anyone who studies the events, there are two marvelous articles, I have to say that, on yesterday's Marxist, I didn't write them, by the way. Two marvelous articles, which really show the way the class is moving in one country after another. One of them is about a fight of the bus drivers, I think, in Barcelona. Marvelous. Where they fought and they won, using marvelous methods coming from below, in opposition, by the way, to the union, to all the union bureaucracies in Spain. The other one is in Switzerland. It's not a country that most comrades would readily identify with the class struggle. A marvelous report of the fight of the workers in the Italian part of Switzerland, I think it's called Ticino. I don't know if Fred is here to correct me. I think it's called Ticino. A marvelous fight against the factory closing, where they fought and they won in a small town of 20,000 people. I'll perhaps return to that later on in the course of my discussion. But what I'm saying to you is that there was a time in the past where in international perspectives you could maybe take one country or another country, maybe it was Portugal, maybe it was Greece, maybe it was Spain. At this moment in time, the class struggle is erupting everywhere. Yes, even in little Switzerland, even in Denmark. We'll come to some very interesting examples in a moment. But we will begin with the economic scenario, the economic situation. And of course, one has to be a bit conditional about economic perspective. We had a bit of a discussion on the Central Committee yesterday about this. It's natural when the documents are drawn up. The process are in an incipient phase. There isn't sufficient hard evidence as to which way it's going. I have to say this, however, that if you take the trouble to read all the documents with the tendencies produced on world economy for the last 10 or 20 years, you see that everything we said has been borne out. And by the way, we don't give ourselves enough of a pat on the back. Comrades are very interested, particularly concerned that if we make the slightest mistake, it's immediately taken up and quite often in the sharpest way. We don't mind that. But for goodness sake, where we do something right, we should give ourselves a pat on the back. And we were right, yes, I'll say that now, on economic perspectives and perspectives for the world economy, this organization alone was correct, I would say even in details, as against every other tendency in the world. Ted used to say, we're the only optimistic people in the labor movement. Well, that's a fact. We're the only cheerful people. All the others are submerged in a morass of pessimism, of doom. From the bourgeois, you just read the bourgeois economists. They don't know what they're doing. They understand nothing of what has occurred. They're alarmed, as a matter of fact. They're panicking. That's the expression. They're panicking. From the bourgeois, through the reformists, just look at the face. There was a marvelous photograph yesterday, one of the, I think it was in the Metro, actually, of, what's his name? He's such an insignificant person. Gordon Brown. I always call him George Brown, people, it shows my age. Gordon Brown sitting with George Bush, and you could see, just look at the photo, you could see the body language. It's like a little boy that's been called into the headmaster's study. His hands on his knees like this, you know. The forced grin on his face in front of the big bass in the White House. The reformists are in crisis. The left reformists are in crisis. I remember a few years ago, I bumped into Tony Benn, who's not the most... He's one of the most intelligent of the left reformists. A couple of years ago, I met him selling the paper on a May Day. The first thing he says to me is, what a terrible world we live in. And they all have this line. From the bourgeois to the right reformists, the left reformists, and every piddling sect in creation, and they're all in crisis and splitting. Because all their perspectives have been demonstrated to be false from start to finish. They're all pessimistic except for us. And the reason why we are optimistic, and we can, we're entitled to be optimistic, is that we know that our perspectives have been demonstrated to be correct time and time again. We explained this economics, we explained the bubble which has sustained the American economy and therefore the world economy for a whole period. It's true, the perspective of a slump was delayed for a whole period. And Marx explains in Capital the role of credit in every boom, as a matter of fact. I have to add to that speculation, and there's been unprecedented speculation in this boom. There's been speculation in every boom since the 17th century, since the Dutch tulip scandal. But the level, the degree, the extent of the speculation now is staggering. It's staggering, it beggars description. It has no precedent, by the way. This is the bigger, the housing boom that we've just been through. Now they're speculating in something else. Now they're speculating in food. It isn't enough that they speculate on people's houses, and now millions of people are faced with repossessions in America. They're now speculating on food. And therefore millions of people are faced with starvation on a world scale. They're becoming alarmed about this. You see, speculation always plays a role in every boom, but the level of this has no precedent, and therefore the reason why they're alarmed, they're seriously alarmed, the reason why they're cutting interest rates desperately, in a desperate attempt to prevent, which will fail, by the way, it will not succeed by those means. The reason why they adopt measures which are irresponsible from a capitalist point of view, because it's frankly irresponsible to attempt to reflate the bubble, that's what they're doing. Whereas in the past, a reasonable economist, a sober-minded bourgeois would want to take some of the steam out of it, would allow a few banks to go bust. Now they're terrified. That's the reason they intervened rapidly. They came running with an open checkbook, so-called New Labour, and it's an absolute disgrace. So the bankers, well, of course, they allowed the mines and the British Leyland, so they allowed them to go bust. That was okay. But when the banks are in difficulties, when the City of London is in difficulties, they come running with an open checkbook. Billions of pounds of the taxpayers' money are made available to these parasites. Complete and absolute parasites, crooks and spibs, who never produced a single atom of productive wealth in their lives, but speculate. They speculate even on debt, which is a colossal, which is an amazing thing. I don't know if they did that in the past, but maybe you can quote me an example, but they've been selling debt, billions of dollars of debt. Would you like to buy some debt? Billions and trillions of dollars, probably. And this enormous speculative, this is the biggest speculative bubble in history, and it must end. And when it does end, of course it will end in tears. We're heading for a serious downturn. And the fact of the matter is that nobody knows how this is going to end. The bourgeois don't know. The economists don't know. That's why they're pessimistic. Because they've now entered into uncharted waters. There's no precedent for this. What sustained the economy for a whole period? And it's a fact. That's what affects some of our older comrades. It's partly old age. It's partly, the cells begin to die off one by one. One tends to lose a little bit of revolutionary spark. This must be frankly admitted to. That's a biological fact. It's also the fact that the communists have had an experience of 20 years. It's a fact. I think in the case of America, it's 25 years. That there has not been a serious economic slump. For 25 years, they've staved it off. There were two recessions in 1990-91, and then I think the other one was 2001. But in both of those occasions, the second one, you hardly noticed it. There wasn't much of a reduction in spending, in consumption at that time, if you look at the figures. And for the first slump, 1990-91, there was such a... But it didn't last very long. I think it was 18 months, couple of years. It wasn't a serious effect. And therefore, they drew the conclusion, because they're empirics, that they could shrug it all off. The conclusion that the bourgeois economists, because they are completely empirical, shallow-minded individuals, is that the boom-slump cycle has been conquered. That's what they say. They're talking about the NEP, the new economic paradigm. You remember that? They don't talk about that anymore. They keep very quiet about this, because it's been exploded. They argued seriously that inflation had been conquered. We will deal with inflation. We see how inflation has been conquered. At the moment, inflation is coming back with a vengeance. It's having dire effects on every country in the world, and it will have an effect on the class struggle. All of these perspectives have been exploded. And there's no argument about this. America is in a recession. The IMF is predicting a recession in 2008, with a little bit behind events. There is a recession in America. In all but name it, that's what it is. Unemployment has risen in March. It rose to 5.1% officially. In practice, it's more than that. And the private sector has been losing jobs for 4 months in a row in America. That's a recession, for goodness sake. Call a spade a shovel. It's having a serious effect. It's having a serious. This is not like the past. That's what these guys don't understand. And I hope that our comrades understand this. That in economics, in political economy, the past is no guide to the future. You just remember that. The fact that they got away with avoiding a serious slump for the last 25 years does not mean to say that they will continue to get away. They will not continue to get away with it. Marx explains that credit, and credit has been an enormous element in this, credit and debt. And there's colossal debt in America and in Britain. Personal, corporate, government debt, external debt, staggering debt. Somebody once said, the American economy has got great because it's built upon a mountain of debt. And the chap added, I think he was The Economist. Yes, but mountains sooner or later have avalanches. There's all sorts of avalanches, by the way. Some avalanches will begin and they will just proceed about 100 yards and they'll proceed no further. You can have the economic and financial equivalent of that. But other avalanches, once they begin, accumulate force and become absolutely irresistible. And that's why they're terrified. I repeat, they're in completely uncharted waters. And what really concerns them is the social and political effects as far as this is concerned. In the States, there's already a collapse, or the beginnings of a collapse, put it that way, of spending, of demand. You see it reflected in the severe crisis in sectors, important sectors, such as the car industry. Automobile industry is a very important component. The car sales are falling. I've got the figures here somewhere. They have fallen. It says last year, that's 2007, sales of cars and light trucks in the USA fell 2.5%. It doesn't seem much. It is a lot, as a matter of fact. This year, it's falling still further. Big companies like Chrysler and Ford are in serious difficulties. Chrysler, last year, Chrysler lost $1.6 billion. It's a serious state of affairs. And Bob Nardelli, one of the gangsters, one of these guys in charge of turning it round. They always find some gangster to turn things round. In what direction they turn them, I'm not quite sure, but they're supposed to turn them round anyway. He was asked, is Chrysler bankrupt? And he answered, I quote, technically no. Technically no. But operationally, yes. And he goes on, this is most interesting. At last, he blurts out the truth. The only thing that keeps us from going into bankruptcy is the $10 billion investors have entrusted with us. God help the investors. Entrusted these guys. So Chrysler and Ford are technically bankrupt. And of course, to this, the construction industry, the collapse of house prices affects the construction. Some economists think, and the bourgeois economists always sing this song. Yes, you can have a financial crisis, but it doesn't necessarily affect the real economy. That's true in the abstract. It's true in the abstract. But in this particular case, it is palpably false. The collapse of house prices in America affects the construction industry. But the construction, that's the real economy, that's not fictitious capital. The building industry builds houses, which is bricks and mortar, for people to live in. That was the main motor force of the American economy. The bottom has dropped out of that. I think there's about 750,000 building workers have lost their jobs in the last 12 months, and that must have an effect on consumption. It has other effects which take their time to work their way through, of course. It takes its time. It takes some months for the full effects to be felt. But it must then affect demand for cement, for bricks, for nails, for steel, for all kinds of electricity. It will take some time to work its way through, but it will work its way through. America, I repeat, is in a recession. Now, the next argument they put forward is quite amusing. These are the same guys that argued that globalization was the magic key to success. Globalization was going to save them. And it is a fact. I don't think one can't deny this. But globalization did assist them. Or to use a Marxist expression, the unprecedented increase in the international division of labor could put it, you know, to look no further. The collapse of Stalinism meant that in the region of 2 billion people entered the world capitalist economy. Now, you can't say that that won't have an effect, of course. It will have an effect. Eastern Europe, Russia, China, above all China, also India. Of course, it had an effect. In the short run, it had an effect in opening up new markets and new fields of investment. Yes, and they were all very pleased about this. The problem is, you spend a lot of money, billions of dollars in China, building factories with the most modern equipment and with a large and quite skilled, or semi-skilled at least, labor force. What's going to happen? Sooner or later, these factories, we have to point this out, many years ago, will produce goods, and not just shoes and ladies' underwear, which you'd associate with the back of the country, but very good televisions, computers, computer parts, chips, high-tech goods. And where are they going to sell these goods? They have to sell them somewhere. Well, some comments spend a lot of time discussing the falling rate of profit, which is very laudable. That's fine. But we mustn't get away from the fact that in order for the capitalist to realize any profit, to realize surplus value, the goods must be sold, for goodness sake. They must be sold in the market. There must be demand. And if there isn't sufficient demand to meet this colossal increase in production in places like China, you're in trouble. And they are in trouble. Serious difficulties exist. And therefore, we have a position now of panic. In other words, what we're saying is that the party is over. It was like a great big party. You know what happens in a party, some of you do. I don't tend to go to many parties myself, except for revolutionary parties. But, you know, people in the party, they will drink rather a lot. Or pop, you know. Ben knows what I'm talking about. They drink a lot, yes, and they drink and they feel very happy, and everyone's happy, and everybody's engaged in this mad carnival, and so on. But there's always somebody at the party, isn't there? Party pooper, there's now. Ted was very good at this. You shouldn't drink so much. How many times have you said that to me? You shouldn't drink so much. You get a bad head in the morning. By God, the man was right. You get a bad head. And of course, it always happens with the alcoholics. The next morning, they swear that they'll never do this again. They've learned their lesson. They've learned from history. What happens when the next party comes up? You know why am I saying this? Because this is precisely what happens in the capitalist economy. There's nothing rational about it. They get involved in what Alan Greenspan now has become very wise in his old age. But even he referred a few years ago to the irrational exuberance of capitalism in this mad. It was mad, quite mad. This carnival of speculation, massive speculation, orgy of speculation. Vast fortunes were made. Vast fortunes are still being made out of this. But of course the party must come to an end. And after the party you get an almighty hangover. And they'll be rubbing their backsides. They are rubbing their backsides. Oh, if only we'd have realised. They've actually got the cheek to say, oh, the Bank of England should have sorted this out earlier. And why did they allow us to do this, you know? As if the Bank of England could have done anything about it. The party is over. The speculative orgy now has been punctured, at least as far as housing is concerned. This has very serious results. It has serious economic results, which I've touched upon. I don't intend to expand. We've dealt with this, and this is not the time. But let's not get away from the fact. It has very serious social effects. And politically, we're talking about millions of families in the States. Poor families in the main, not only poor, middle class families, in some cases, are faced with losing the roof over their head. I think 1 million of families have already been repossessed. And that will happen in Britain. Negative equity, I'll deal with that. It's an international phenomenon. People will lose their houses. This is a serious matter. There was a little incident. Sometimes, you know, you can learn more from a little anecdote than any amount of facts and figures. That in America there's such a thing as you've heard of road rage, you know, drivers become infuriated because of the snarl up of the traffic and so on. They begin to fight and injure each other, you can kill each other in some cases. In America, there's a new phenomenon. Now it's home rage. Yes, families that are threatened with repossession destroy their homes deliberately. Smash holes through the walls, pour paint over the carpets, and so on. In revenge. It's like a kind of despairing gesture against the injustice which has been been committed. But the interesting point made by The Economist was this. They observed this, and they said the following. The first reaction of people, I'm talking about America here, not Zimbabwe, the first reaction of people in this situation is disbelief. That's an important point, because the American dream, you know what it was, that you work hard, you advance, you get a house, you get a car, you get on in life, become rich. That's finished. The American dream is punctured. That's the first very important psychological effect. It's not just a question of facts and figures. This is wrong. It has a psychological effect on society. First reaction is disbelief. How can this happen to me? What have I done? The second reaction is fear. And the third reaction is anger. The Economist is saying this, not me. Third reaction is anger. That little sentence is pregnant with all kinds of consequences. What you have here in embryonic form is precisely what will occur in the United States of America. We'll predict that now in the next period.